This is Tim Ross, and I'm talking to Adam on FilmWax.
Okay, climate change deniers. Are you going to tell me that after, what are we going on, a week, 90 plus temperatures, humidity off the charts? Okay, forget it. I'm not going to get into it. This show is about cinema. It's not about the environment. I got to start another show for that. But in the meantime, my name is Adam Chartoff. How are you? The name of this show is FilmWax Radio, and this is episode 494. Did you know that the 500th episode is coming up in just a couple of weeks? All right, maybe more than a couple, but a few weeks. Yeah, this summer we're going to have the 500th episode. It's such a milestone. On episode 100, I talked to Trish Dalton and her co-directing partner on the documentary they made. But Trish is still a good friend. I knew her before that she came on the show, of course, but she has a workspace in downtown Brooklyn, and I'm able to share it with her. So thank you to Trish Dalton. In fact, one of the segments on this episode was recorded out of there. The acoustics aren't always the best, but it's a nice option, let me tell you, to have a space to do some of these episodes in downtown Brooklyn. It's a terrific opportunity. And that segment is with Iyabo Boyd, and that'll be coming up in a minute. But I wanted to talk about the 500th episode because I'm going to announce who's going to be on it in a moment. I said Trish was on the 100th episode, and I didn't really have even an intention of making. I never thought I'd get to 200 episodes. I really didn't. But when I did, I believe that was that Barbara Koppel, I believe, was on the 200th episode. And then on the 300th, I remember it was John Sayles. And then I was going to try to get, again, I thought, you know, 400th episode, let me get Owner back on. Because I think it had been a while. And to date, he is the most frequent guest I've had on the show. So Owner was on the 400th. And on the 500th episode will be one of my favorite directors working today, Ramin Barani, will be on our 500th episode. So we are meeting in a couple of days, and we're going to knock out this episode. So unless something happens that would sabotage that will be our 500th episode. And I do want to also announce that on the next episode, on the 495th episode, we have in addition to a segment on this new fantastic film, Eighth Grade, where we're going to be talking to the director, Bo Burnham, as well as several of the cast. We have a very special guest also on the 495th episode. So special that I'm not going to tell anybody. But it's a definite bucket list cross-off, if you will, for me. As is Ramin. These are spectacular. And I'm working on a couple of more that seem very likely. This has been a great, great time. I just only, what, about 20 episodes? The last 15 episodes I had on Paul Schrader. So this is all wonderful stuff. You have to understand, even at this far along, I'm always surprised, and pleasantly so, that I'm getting on so many wonderful filmmakers. And this episode, 494, is no different. We have two filmmakers on. First of all, we're going to talk to Kimberly Reed, who is a fine documentary filmmaker in her own right. I met her some long time ago, and a few years ago. And I had seen her film, Prodigal Sons, which you got to see. It's just such a spectacular documentary. She was one of Filmmaker Magazine's 25 New Faces of Independent Film some years back. So I knew who she was. And I had run into her over time, as I mentioned, and I kept asking her, come on the show. You know, there's a number of filmmakers who are probably just more into doing it when the timing is right. They have something to talk about. And so finally the time came. I get an email from Kimberly. And her new documentary, which we're going to talk about, is called Dark Money, is about to come out. And we met at the Montclair Film Festival and discussed this documentary. So we're going to get to that conversation. And I'm so glad she finally was able to come on. As I mentioned, the second segment is with another filmmaker named Iyabo Boyd. Now, Iyabo was on episode, I think, 51. So she's one of my first guests I ever had. And she's back after 400 episodes or so, more than that. And I'm so glad that she is back on. She has a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for her, I think this might be her directorial debut, because she's been a producer. an industry professional for years, and now she wants to get in on directing, and so she's raising money for this short film. She's got about a week left of the campaign. It's on Kickstarter. She so far has about 300 backers, and she is, I'd say, closing in on the two-third mark, something like that. We're going to get to that in just a little bit after the conversation with Kimberly, though. But anyway, I'm just going to mention it. Check it out real fast. Kickstarter, Me Time, a feminist sex comedy. And her name again, my friend Iyabo Boyd. I-Y-A-B-O. Boyd. So search for that, Me Time, and consider backing that project. So the last thing I wanted to talk about before we get into the show is a documentary I went to see the other day, and I really enjoyed it. I went to see Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is, you know, Morgan Neville's new documentary. Morgan's been on the show a few times. We didn't get him on for this film, but maybe we will. Maybe he'll sit down for like a retro conversation, meaning a kind of a career retrospective. Anyway, what a beautiful film, though. I mean, I don't know. I have this, you know, sentimental component to my personality. And if you listen to the show, you probably know I'm a sensitive kind of dude. And I grew up on Mr. Rogers, like a lot of people. So, you know, it was just a really, I thought, an amazing. And I learned a lot about the guy I did not know. And I recommend it if you can get out to it. Now, during the trailers was one for Three Identical Strangers. I think that's the name of the Three Identical. If you, I gotta go see that. That looks also incredibly entertaining. About these three brothers who are living, you know, they were all separated, literally separated at birth, and discover each other by accident. That they're, you know, first two of them find each other by running into each other, because one of them moves to the same neighborhood or town that the other one lives in, and they keep being told, didn't I just see you somewhere? And they begin to, then they meet. I haven't seen it yet. And then there's a third one, brother. It's an incredible story, apparently. And then that's not even the end of it. So anyway, I'm sure there'll be a fiction version soon. If you've seen it, let me know what you think. You know, tweet to me. You can tweet directly to me under my name or on my FilmWax, the FilmWax account. You can, of course, contact us through Facebook or Instagram. We have the website. You can email us through there. There's a link right there. It's very easy to reach us here at FilmWax Radio. And by us, I mean me. So this episode, let's get right to it. The name of the movie is called Dark Money. And it is, it's a dark subject. Make no mistake. It's a political thriller. Dark Money examines one of the greatest present threats to American democracy, the influence of untraceable corporate money on our elections and elected officials. The film takes us viewers to Montana, which is the home state of Kimberly Reed, the director, to the front lines in the fight to preserve fair elections nationwide, and follow an integral local journalist whose name, by the way, is John Adams, interestingly enough. And I mention it because I know he's going to be at a number of screenings. One of the strands of the movie follows John, who's working to expose the real-life impacts of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Through this gripping story, Dark Money uncovers the shocking and vital truth of how American elections are bought and sold. This Sundance Award-winning documentary is directed, produced by Kimberly Reed, produced by Katie Cheveny. And also, I wanted to mention, because he's a pal, my friend J. Arthur Sternberg, who is also one of the filmmakers on the team, who did this podcast some years ago when we did our episode on Brasslands some time ago. So let's get into it right now. My conversation with Kimberly Reed. Let me just also mention that beside the fact that the film is going to have its theatrical run here in New York City beginning July 13th, that's a week from Friday, we'll be at the IFC Center. And there'll be Q&As with Kimberly and John, the journalist, after select screenings, so you'll on that opening weekend, so you'll want to check that out. In Washington, D.C., the film opens on July 20th at the E Street Cinema, and also in Philly at the Landmark Theaters, Ritz at the Bourse. And on July 27th, it opens in Marin, California, Chicago, San Francisco, Baltimore, Berkeley, Los Angeles, and on check local listings, please. You can go to the website and get on their mailing list, check out the trailer. which I'm going to play a little clip for you right now, actually, and then we'll go into my conversation with Kimberly Reed, coming from Montclair, New Jersey, only on FilmWax, FilmWax Radio.
You know, the number one rule of political or watchdog reporting is follow the money.
John Adams here. I covered the legislature for the Great Falls Tribune.
A source of mine had come across something that I might be interested in. Voters in your district had never seen something.
No, this was a whole new political attack.
They send out all these mailings. They don't care if they lie.
Nobody knows who they are. They call them dark money groups, and that's exactly what they are.
Corporation funnels money to a dark money group. They send out postcards attacking the opponent. When that candidate gets elected, they support the agenda of the corporation.
I don't know how to fight them. I can't pick up the phone and say, hey, what's your interest in candidate X? Because I don't know who they are.
And it's not just Montana.
Campaign finance is the gateway to every other issue that you might care about. Americans are
barraged by... I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't have the mind for it. Yet another one, especially coming out of this movie I just came out of, which is Dark River. This is a heavy-duty movie. Really? It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with Dark Money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nice to sit down with you finally.
Yeah.
Officially.
Yes, here we are.
Here we are. Long roads lead to FilmWax, right? Anyway, how are you?
Doing okay.
Kimberly Reed. Yeah.
It's, we're here at the Montclair Film Festival, which is kind of my backyard.
Your backyard, so, your local festival.
I drove over. It's kind of cool to do a local festival.
Yeah. So you had your premiere last night? Was it yesterday or was it was Saturday?
The premiere at Montclair Film Festival was yesterday, yeah.
Your hometown premiere.
Hometown premiere, yeah.
Where did it have its world premiere?
The world premiere of Dark Money was at Sundance 2018, and it kind of feels like we already had the hometown premiere because we were at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival, which is this great film festival, and that's where the film takes place, so that felt a little bit like our backyard,
and we
were the opening night film, so it was really fun.
Yeah, oh, that's incredible, opening night film, so that's their big, that's the main film.
Yeah, they like kicked it off.
And it was also in part because you are from?
Because I'm from there, from Montana.
Where in Montana are you from?
Helena,
that's the capital of the state.
That's the capital city.
And this is your second feature that you've directed.
That's right.
You produced.
Yep.
I know you recently produced for...
David France,
who's, has been on this podcast.
Oh, cool.
And...
The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson.
P. Johnson, yeah, which is available on Netflix, since we brought it up.
Yeah.
The new film is called Dark Money, and it is a term now that's sadly becoming part of the vernacular, right?
Yes.
It's kind of... the result of working the system, working the political gifting system, right?
Yeah. The IRS created these nonprofit organizations. Almost everybody knows what a 501c3 is, but there's also
we're at one right now.
We're at one right now at Montclair, Film Commission, nonprofit organizations. But with C3 designation, you can't talk about politics at all. Almost everybody knows what a 501c3 is, just a regular nonprofit organization that does not have to pay taxes. There's also something called a C4, 501c4 organization, and it's supposed to be a social welfare nonprofit organization. In our neighborhood, couple neighborhoods over
here in New Jersey.
We have a neighborhood association that's a C4. That's what a C4 is supposed to be doing. Like, we clean up the park and try to,
doing good.
Yeah, it's so doing things that, for the social welfare.
Benefit the welfare of the community.
Yeah, but soon after the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court, which was in 2010. Carl Rove actually kind of pioneered this loophole and saw that you could take a C4 organization, which is supposed to not have the majority of their operations taking place with a political purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You can't It's not like a C3 where they say you have to do absolutely zero politicking. But that can't be your main purpose. Mm-hmm. So what he did was to kind of create this nonprofit organization that donors could give to. Those donors would not be divulged. We would never know who those donors are. And that dark money group could operate. They do all sorts of tricks with the books and make it look like less than half of their. Most people think that if you do less than half of your business, half of everything you do is engaged in politics, that you're below a threshold that the IRS is kind of not go after you because your main purpose is not politicking. If, you know, 49% of what you do has to do with politics. So there's lots of ways to get around that. People just kind of give money to each other and make it look like that's the other half of their business. And, you know, Money Group A will give it to Dark Money Group B. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they get a bunch of money.
If
they
you're clever enough and crafty enough and motivated enough, I guess you can figure out how to work the system.
Yes.
As it were, right to your advantage. And so tremendous amounts of money are being floated to, I mean, it's basically special interests then. Mm-hmm. Are still giving money to politicians, right? And then influencing the outcomes.
And if you have a C4, a dark money group, you can, since Citizens United, those donations are unlimited. Mm-hmm. And with a dark money group, they're also anonymous.
Right.
And there actually kind of used to be a pretty strong distinction between a super PAC and a dark money group. Mm-hmm. But now people use them hand in hand so much. Like, for example, we talked about Karl Rove in 2012 election cycle. He created Crossroads GPS as a dark money group that would be a companion to his super PAC, American Crossroads. All they do is just pass money back and forth to further obfuscate the system. And, you know, of course, all of this
is for, Mitt Romney? What was that election?
They've played in a bunch of different elections. Actually, 2012, we're talking about Montana. Tester ran for Senate. It was a very important seat in 2012. And
back in the news.
He's back in the news because he's running again 6 years later, which is how long it took me.
But he also... He also turned the spotlight on to Jackson, Ronnie Jackson, right?
Jackson.
Isn't he the one that kind of blew the whistle on him?
Who Trump has recently appointed to be a...
head of the VA.
Head of the VA.
Lead the VA, yeah.
Yeah, and Tester pointed out a couple reasons why that may not be a good idea.
Yes, right. And it's no longer an idea. Yes. it's an ex-idea now.
He would do, but it looks like Trump's still going after Tester. We'll see.
Right. Well, what is your connection to Montana? Well, we already established you're from Montana. So the film, though, this is your way in, I should say, right, into making the documentary was that you were finding that back home, the state of Montana, it seemed to be one of the more especially affected states.
That's right. Yeah. You know, when I heard about the Citizens United decision, I didn't quite know what to do. Like a lot of people, it was just kind of gobsmacked at this decision coming from the Supreme Court. But I really saw my home state of Montana really fighting back with a lot of these campaign finance issues. Mm-hmm. It's rare that you see kind of a clear antagonist and protagonist with these issues of money and politics. And usually, you know, people don't want to stand up and declare themselves either the protagonist or the antagonist, either the person who's trying to, you know, in the case of what was going on in Montana, the same group of lawyers who were behind Citizens United were also opening offices in Montana and trying to erode Montana's relatively strong campaign finance laws because they saw that, you know, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. If we can erode these laws, we can do it across the U.S. And I saw all of these legislative volleys happening in the state. But I also, having grown up there, understood how Montanans were going to push back because there's a very strong culture against corporate control of politics, against corruption in political campaigns. And most of that is because, you know, there's not a lot of people that live in Montana. It's a resource-rich state, so there's lots of people who want to come in and develop those natural resources. And what you usually find is that money coming in, trying to control the politics so you can control the laws that let you pull lots of money out of them thar hills. And that's been happening for a century, and Montanans have seen the result of it. By and large, there's in the film, we kind of metaphorically use this thing called the Berkeley Pit, which is the largest Superfund site that is just a big toxic pit of water that has a well-established pattern of killing birds, especially huge flocks of snow geese that land in the Berkeley Pit.
Right, and I know from time to time, headed for their doom. It's tragic.
Basically, the Berkeley Pit used to be a massive open pit mine.
Okay.
The Berkeley Pit used to be a massive open pit mine where you just, you know, open a huge hole in the earth.
Yeah.
When you do that and you mine below the water table, you got to pump the water out of this big massive hole in the earth.
Right, sure.
When it was kind of hit that whisper number where it was no longer profitable to mine, they actually shut down the mine, which meant letting their groundwater come back in. But that groundwater is being filtered through, you know, the mining waste. So it's incredibly acidic.
Right.
It's full of heavy metals, and it's just completely toxic.
Right, and then it gets into everything.
Yep.
Right? And not only just the drinking water, but the whole sort of...
It's a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And it's close to getting so full, this massive pit is close to getting so full that it's going to start spilling over the top. So everybody's trying to figure out what to do with it now and how to remediate it. And,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
So. It's a disaster. Yeah. And put on top of that a layer of deregulation fervor, which is going on, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now in this country, like crazy, like mad, right? And that can't help.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So what are you going to do? But the way this gets used in the film is that this pit is kind of a, you know, it's the way I think a lot of Montanans think of it. It's this sore that is a result of corporate control of politics. Mm-hmm. Every Montanan grows up learning about the battles between the Copper Kings in Butte, Montana. Butte, Montana is known as the richest hill on earth. Mm-hmm. The lot of the copper wiring in some of these buildings around here probably came from Butte, Montana.
Okay.
And it was, you know, the city that electrified the nation. And there's a lot of early labor movement. It was the city that electrified the nation. So hearing about these battles between these industrialists in the early 1900s was a history that I was very familiar with. And it's in a lot of ways, it's just the ambiance that people who grow up there have of this kind of basic distrust of industrialists with a lot of money who are coming in to, you know, remove natural resources. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of a metaphorical way that these guys, this history, these industrialists work. But there were also some very specific, not metaphorical things that happened as a result of that. One of which was the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, which was a broad-based citizens initiative 100 years ago that where Montana just said, look, we're tired of this. We're tired of this corruption, this rampant corruption where one rich guy, they were thinking of this guy named William A. Clark, where one rich guy can come in and buy up all the newspapers and buy up all the mines and buy up all the, and essentially run politics in the state. There's this famous story where William A. Clark took out ads in his own newspapers saying, this was back when when legislators would elect senators. We now have the direct election of senators, but this is when, you know, people who were elected to the state legislature would elect senators. And he, and William A. Clark took out ads in his newspapers offering to pay each legislator who voted for him to go to the Senate. He would pay them $10,000.
Just
which
like
was
that.
An enormous amount. Oh,
but 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
An enormous
That's
amount.
That's like $1 million now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he would have his henchmen standing on the edge on the, of the floor of the legislature with little envelopes, had his initials on it, you know, passing out, you know, these envelopes. Or the other thing they would do is throw them over the transom into the hotel where all the legislators stayed. Actually, this just so happened that William A. Clark was elected, you know, senator under this this plan. And he went to Washington, D.C., and he, when he got there, the sitting senators were so disgusted with the corruption that was going on in Montana, they refused to seat him, and they kicked him out.
Wow.
Sent him back to Montana. And yeah, so the,
they had their standards.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of long story short, the Montanans said, look, that we're done with this. We don't want corporate money in politics.
Right.
And we're going to keep corporate money, corporate donations from being able to go directly to candidates. And, you know, we just we don't want to have that in our politics. We've seen that this wrecks it. And so one of the things that we follow in the film is kind of based on this strong history of resisting corporate money in politics is we follow the attorney general at the time. His name was Steve Bullock, as he takes a case led by Montana with about half of the states signing on. And he goes to the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Citizens United. At least that's what the case was. It did not turn out that way. The U.S. Supreme Court summarily reversed Montana's 100-year-old law, and that's the kind of the ground in which all of this kind of fight against the influence of money in politics takes place.
Wow. Another theme in this is journalism, right, in the film, because there is one lone voice, in a sense. Well, you know, there are more than one, of course, but your film has a hero in an old-fashioned journalist, a kind of guy who likes to do journalism the old-fashioned way. You know, one man standing against sort of the wind of the wave of corruption and cynical politics and all, and he's fighting a really strong resistance.
Yeah, his name is John S. Adams. Should we wait for that?
No, that's... No, that's my ride. I have to. Oh, is that one of the Teslas up front? I don't know.
Yeah, I want one.
We're at a film festival. There, you know, we're not trying to hide that. That there's all sorts of activities.
It's got to be really annoying talking to filmmakers all the time, because I always overseeing of the, like.
There's been some, there's some that come in and they're very, very hyper aware, like yourself. It's a nice thing.
Didn't say anything about the HVAC yet. So.
No, I know. I'm aware too. This is a relatively benign. I've been in ones where kind of all of a sudden you'll be talking and it just sort of like kicks in. Yeah. And cool. I just sort of say, well, you know, this is about the content, not the. Always about the sonic quality, but
yeah.
And also I'm invariably in, you know, however many flights up from the street, and the sound just leaks into the show. Mm-hmm. The sounds of the city escape.
Good.
So it's part of my show. Honks, sirens,
it's the
people screaming for their lives. I'm not sure what that
I think the phone over there is ringing.
Oh, is that a phone?
Yeah.
It's hard for me to.
I think the phone is ringing.
Anyway, John S. Adams, is that what you said? Or John?
I think it's really a David and Goliath story about
it is. He's
this
like an old, really,
John S. Adams trying to. So our film is about money in politics and the influence of money in politics, and the way that you break it down. The way that you combat that system is, one, you need a strong watchdog press that has people reporting on this.
Right.
And there was actually, the film took 6 years to
really
make, so it kind of follow these different election cycles. And 2004, we're kind of plugging away. In 2012, we're kind of plugging away. Mm-hmm. This was the first election cycle I followed. In 2014, you saw, you know, the influence of these dark money groups grow. And then suddenly, when everybody was, they had a culture of people who were paying attention to this and a very, very strong fourth estate in the press mm-hmm. who was covering all of these issues, within the space of a couple weeks, all of the statehouse bureaus in Montana were shut down. There's one major newspaper chain called Lee Newspapers, and they fired two reporters who had, they didn't really fire them, they offered them buyouts, but
same,
it was,
same results.
Yeah, they shut it down. Mm-hmm. And a couple weeks apart from that, John Adams, essentially the same thing happened to him from the, it was called the Great Falls Tribune, which is a Gannett newspaper, and it's emblematic of the collapse that's going on with the print industry and with Statehouse news coverage. And it became a very natural subplot to follow, you know, when we're mm-hmm. trying to focus on these issues in the film and digging in with John
sure.
as our
right.
as our envoy, as our, you know, kind of leading us through these investigations to figure out who's behind all this stuff. All of a sudden, the newspaper just shut down their state bureaus. So it was very dramatic. And
yeah.
a lot of people really worried what was going to happen. And kind of mild spoiler alerts here, but, you know, John finds a way to regroup and to start up his own news service. I'll have folks kind of see how that goes in the film. But it's like, yeah, he becomes this kind of crusading.
Who was the writer? But the point is that he represents, in a way, what we're seeing with you know, with this journalist and with all the other components of the film is we're seeing a kind of a granular version or sample of what seems to be going on in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like all of a sudden there's a lot at stake and a lot in jeopardy in terms of our basic principles, our basic you know, American principles and values mm-hmm. and our rights we sort of take for granted. And then there's the John who kind of, you know, he's standing there with his little sword, but he also represents hope in a way, you know, because it does come down to the grassroots.
I think he really does.
Yeah.
Like one of the, last night at the film festival, mm-hmm. we had we're here in New Jersey, and there was a local reporter who basically started up their own news service after layoffs at the Bergen Record and the Newark Star-Ledger. And he is a member of this organization called the Institute for Nonprofit News, INN.org.
Mm-hmm.
So we tracked him down through this, you know, organization of basically local journalists who are trying to just fighting to keep covering these really important issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a sense of hope, as you say, and there's also a sense of just real threat, because one of the things I think that happens in our film that I think is really exciting when you're watching it is that we have this series of really bizarre leaks that other people and John Adams start chasing down.
Mm-hmm.
And it just happens that, you know, when you scratch the surface of what's really going on in most politics, you just find, every time you turn the light on, you see a bunch of bugs squirming all over the place, and you actually
yeah, right.
see what's going on all the time. And that's what happens with these leaks that show up, these leaks of documents and emails that show up in our film. And, you know, when that is happening all the time,
mm-hmm.
and when you know that a journalist, if they can just focus on this stuff and flip on those light switches, this is what they see all the time, this rampant corruption, it makes it pretty scary when you start to consider that these journalists are just going to not be there and not be turning on those light switches, and that rampant corruption that's going on is going to continue to fester.
You know, I was watching the Senate hearings. No, excuse me, congressional hearings on Scott Pruitt last week. And I was just sort of amazed by how their partisanship has taken such hold on these politicians that it's more important to them than the environmental threat against their own constituency in their own states. That there are congressmen from you know, the heartland states, which all have some, there's a lot of threats against, you know, their environment, the environments in their states and parkland and other resources. And but that's more important to them that they support this corrupt guy, Pruitt, than it is for them to do their job. You know, yeah. I can't believe it's at that point. You know,
there's one guy the other day, Mitch Mulvaney, who runs the Congressional Budget Office.
Right.
I think he runs both the CBO and the whatever they recently renamed Elizabeth Warren's partner for the, I don't know what it's called. But Mick Mulvaney said, if you're a lobbyist and you don't donate any money to me, mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk to you. If you're a lobbyist and you do donate money, I might talk to you. Yeah. Mick Mulvaney.
Yeah, I said, saw that's right. Yeah. Just and, blatantly, not even ashamed of or, you know, self-conscious of.
And this is what I think. This is what people in our country on both the right and the left, on all sides of political, are just like, think this is what's going on. They suspect it's what's going on, and mm-hmm. it is what's going on.
Right.
And, you know, again, scratch the surface just a little bit, and this is what you find.
Again, the film is called Dark Money. Where is the film going next? 'Cause, and also, we were going to maybe hold on to this till the broadcast.
Yeah, so we've had a really fun and I think effective
festival run. Yeah, it's pretty impressive actually.
Yeah, and the really cool thing about it too is that, you know, the film uses Montana as a microcosm to show this is how it works. This is how you can understand what's going on with money and politics and what to do about it. So it's been fun to take the film to different places where, you know, people see this Montana microcosm, but then in the Q&As after the film, they just take it and apply it to the local situation.
They recognize
what's going on. Because it's a very, you know, it's easy to map on. You know, this is not uncommon.
And so the festival conversations are very gratifying because you're able to kind of share that with people. And
yeah, people are really applying the film to their own circumstances, which is what we wanted to do with the film. And then we open in theaters starting on July 13th at the IFC Center here in New York, mm-hmm. and 2018. And we're going to do platform release out from there through the fall, and then have I don't know if we know the exact date right now of the broadcast, but it's going to be this fall. Before the election, mm-hmm. on POV.
Oh, that's
so
good.
So check your local PBS listings.
Well, and we'll remind people where they can see it. But
great.
We'll hopefully get people into the theaters to see Dark Money, directed by Kimberly Reed. And you've got J. Arthur Sternberg, who helping, right, on the film. Who's
a friend. Jay's a great editor, and he and the Meerkat Media Collective were kind of enlisted a lot of them in helping on this film. A lot of the cinematography came from Eric Phillips Horst, who's also in Meerkat.
And by the way, since we brought up the Meerkat, well, this is going to go up after the fact, probably. But as I say, as we talk, they're doing sort of an open call for new members.
Yeah,
for the first time in a long time.
They are first time in a long time looking for new members of the co-op. And they also have an artist residency that they tend to have open calls for. So people should keep an eye out for that, too.
And your producer,
Katie Chevigny came on to help produce after I'd been kind of plugging away for a while, and mm-hmm. I think really helped us, you know, mm-hmm. land the film, brought on a lot of investors. We have a pretty complicated blend of investors and donations and a lot of support from the Ford Foundation and Threshold Foundation, Chicago Media Project.
Well, I hope
chicken and egg, yay!
Yeah, great people. Yeah. I hope the film really, really sparks a real fire in people's, you know, under people's, I don't know, their cockles. What do they get? Their fire.
Their hackles.
How do you get hackles?
Get their hackles.
Get their hackles. That's what it is.
We
get
want
people
hackles.
Angry and get them on their feet and get them protesting.
And I think it gives people a sense of hope too. I mean, there's a lot of documentaries out there that get you all kind of scared
and agitated,
I think there are things we can do about this, and I think our film shows that too.
Right. Well, hopefully maybe we'll even follow up. Maybe we'll have another opportunity to sit and do a part two of this. But
yeah,
this
maybe like after theatrical and before broadcast or something.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Bump it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Terrific. All right. Thanks.
Thank you so much for
Your
persistence.
Oh, yeah. No,
to finally connect.
Awesome. For sure. Songs on this episode of the podcast are by the musical artist Olivia Cheney off her new album, Shelter, distributed by Nonesuch Records.
Each night when I return,
Me Time is an earnest feminist comedy about a black woman named Deborah, who is super wound up after a hectic workday and is thinking about just how to decompress. One part of her psyche, Sexy Deb, appears and tries to bully her into going out to a bar for a hookup, while Soulful Deb wants to light some incense, and she suggests Deb try some self-care stroking. But then Scary Deb shows up and whines that she just wants Deb to eat cereal and watch Gilmore Girls. Well, Me Time is a comedy, and as I mentioned, it will be directed by Yabo Boyd. And let's see, they're right now a little over the 12,000 mark. The project needs to reach its goal by Thursday, a week from today, at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. Please consider backing the project. Again, go to Kickstarter.com. Search for Iabo or search for Me Time and check out the video, check out the rewards, consider getting on board. Here's my conversation with friend filmmaker Iabo Boyd for her second appearance on Filmwax Radio.
Love is on this balcony, naked where I rest my feet. We roam, roam and ruin, swift swallow. Swoop and screech. This is our time under umbrella pines. Darling, can you cope with my high-hearted ideals and demands?
You know, I was just checking out when last you were on
the
podcast. Do you want to? This is going to be episode. I know it's rather crazy, just because I have like some sort of disorder about the podcast. Like okay. I do way too much of it, but not saying that this shouldn't be on the podcast. I'm just saying I do a lot. I've done a lot in the last 7-8 years, but this is going to be episode 494.
Yeah,
that you're on.
Exciting
Thursday. Right, but do you want to know what the last time you were on? What number that was?
So that was, I think it was 2014. Maybe it was.
I don't think so.
It might have been 2013. Are we thinking? What year is it? 2018.
Well, I pulled it up because I was kind of curious.
Yeah, I think it was 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna guess 107.
This is shocking even to me. But this was a very different. I was still doing it as a internet radio show, I think, at then with the Box Radio. And yeah. I was one of my friends when I just started doing remote. Like usually I did them in the studio live. And then they would be podcast at some point, like after that. But anyway, point being, 51. Number 51.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like at the very beginning. So you're one of the first. It's nice to bring you back on.
I'm one of the cool kids. First 100. I think that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Now, the name of the film is called?
Me Time.
Me Time. And it's a short.
It's a short comedy. Yeah. It's a short, earnest, feminist comedy. Comedy.
Okay. Earnest feminist.
Yeah.
That's how. Okay. And you are trying to raise X amount. How much?
$22,000.
Oh, that's okay. That's very doable. And
I think we just passed $10,000.
Oh, great! That's a benchmark.
Yeah.
And so, you're about almost halfway, or where are you at with the what's the deadline?
Oh yeah, halfway through. So the deadline is July 12th at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. So go to Kickstarter. We're going to just say right from the top here before we even describe in more detail.
Sure.
You can find the campaign. I watched the video. It's funny. You kind of temporarily cast yourself as the main character, but you are planning to... Oh, no, you have cast.
We have cast.
So this is production costs.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, there's not...
Above.
Yeah.
Everything.
There's not really cost besides that when you're making it short.
No, right. It's a one dash to the finish line, I suppose, as opposed to when you're doing a feature, it just can take so long and there's so many components to it and you don't know how it's going to be necessarily financed and financing plans change all along the way. So you're always kind of... Yeah, but this is... You kind of have to plan, I guess, the thing because it's going to happen. And you shoot something like this in how many days, for instance? How many days would it take to shoot?
Shooting 3 days.
Yeah.
And it's probably in early August. And with shorts, it feels like you're kind of fundraising all at once. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe, in the fall, if I could raise more money or something to go
maybe
to
festivals.
Post or something. Or yeah,
oh,
or
okay.
for like that. Yeah, the festival push, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Shorts, funding shorts is kind of its own beast, it seems like. You kind of have to like figure it out. Outside of the system. I mean, Kickstarter really helps with that, but in terms of like getting money from, organizations or grants, it doesn't make sense to wait for a grant for 5 months to do a short film.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And and you'll get nothing but get a lot of people criticizing you because they're going to say, you just go out and do it. You can't wait for, I think a feature is a whole other ballgame.
Yeah, but the thing about it is that shorts are super important for how a filmmaker develops, and people who are able to afford to make shorts are either doing them for very, very cheap, and they may not, be as high quality as they should be for what they're trying to do, which is like have a calling card, or something. And so if it doesn't have like, super high quality, it's like kind of hurting that calling card thing anyways. But like to have high quality, you have to spend money, and oftentimes I think short filmmakers are just using that money out of their own pockets, asking friends and family kind of thing.
Sure. You kind of answered my next question just now, because I was going to ask you why you chose to make a short as opposed to just making a feature film.
Yeah.
But is it fair to say the answer would be because it's important to the development of a filmmaker to do the short route?
Yeah, I mean, I'm making a short because I wanted to make this film. It sort of just came to me. Me Time comes from a really, authentic and personal place. And I think it's like a key component in the kinds of films that I want to make, which are really personal, but also really universal. On a bigger way, it's about women's sexuality, it's about masturbation, it's about inhibitions and all the sort of chatter in your head when you're trying to maybe like tap into something with yourself but aren't able to. And so my character in the film's name is Deborah, so instead of kind of pushing those voices out away from her, the ones who are saying, I'm stressed out, what are we going to do, I need to decompress. The ones who are saying, well, let's go, there's like a self-care version of her that is interested in self-love and masturbation as a way, as a healing and a positive activity that is like enriching and empowering and will replenish, something that a person needs or, make you feel more grounded. And so that's one aspect of her. So the thing is that with Me Time, there's Deborah, and then there's three aspects of herself that kind of pop out in the film. And so that one is called Soulful Deb. And then there's Sexy Deb, who is a version of Deborah who, like, fondly remembers what I call the slut years, you know, in your early 20s. Mm-hmm. When... Is it what? I said it. You're was... like, I don't know what that is.
Well, that's another show. Okay. I had slut years, but it was way later than that.
Right, okay.
I was desperately on... Oh, yeah, go ahead. I apologize.
I mean, everyone's slut years are different, and that's okay.
Yes, it is okay, yes.
Yeah, so, but sometimes, you know... So this character, Sexy Deb, like, sort of fondly remembers them as, like, a distant past, and it's like, oh, but remember that? That was nice. Mm-hmm. You know, but then there's... and then there's, like, a scaredy cat version of Deborah who is sort of... just wants to just, like, you know, chill out and watch Gilmore Girls and eat oatmeal and kind of is just, like, mm-hmm. Is holding all the inhibitions between the four of them. I can't remember what I was to say.
Oh, well, you know, you're describing these components of, mm-hmm. of one's personality. Right. So do you feel like it's a matter of that exists inside of you?
Yeah.
And so therefore it's all about how you manage those things. Getting through the day and through your world, right, is how you manage those three people within you.
Well, yeah, and so I think I was going to say, instead of pushing them away, Deborah chooses to engage with them.
Okay.
And so they have the film is basically a conversation between them about each of their perspectives about their sexuality and sort of their own evolution as separate pieces and how they mesh together and those inhibitions and things that I refer to, like, pushing through something to connect with yourself in a different way. And so even though, you know, people maybe cringe at the word masturbation or feel like it's really kind of a personal thing to talk about, or I mean, maybe more with women than with guys. But it is, it's personal, but it's completely universal. You know, every single woman I talk to about this film is mm-hmm. like, oh, I'm this Deb, I'm that Deb, I'm this Deb, and that Deb. Yeah. Like, it completely... everyone identifies with it.
Sure.
And most men that I talk to are like, that's great. You know, they just want to support. They're like,
yeah,
right on.
It's funny. Like, yeah, all of the contributions have been men so far. The $10,000.
Oh, for
kidding.
What?
I'm just kidding. For your film. I'm just kidding.
Right? I know.
It'd be funny, though.
No, oh, that Do would
you,
be funny.
Are you going to cast three different... Well, I understand that you'll have one main actor who's mm-hmm. going to play, you know, Deborah. And then are you going to have three other actors, or are you going to have Deborah play all four roles in a way?
It's one actress, okay. And she's been cast. Her name is Adenike Thomas.
Oh, okay.
She's playing all four Deborahs.
Yeah.
So this is going to be really a fun challenge, like using visual effects. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, just like you might have seen in Orphan Black or United States of Tara or mm-hmm. other films where there's one actress playing multiple characters, where you see them all on screen at the same time, we're going to be able to play with that kind of stuff. So
right.
It's like not only just like, you know, kind of a fun comedy and like, you know, a feminist conversation, but it's also, you know, some interesting special effects that we don't often get to see, like women filmmakers get to play with.
Yeah.
And also a really robust role for an African-American actress, which we also never get to see. Mm-hmm. So she's playing four different people, really, but who are all in the center of the same person. So there's all these nuances to, like, find the core and then find the little pieces to pull out for each one.
Terrific.
So, yeah, I'm excited.
She's going to be very busy.
Yeah.
Because it's... Because it's kind of funny because you're going to have to reshoot, it seems like a lot. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to use, how do you do that? Do you still use somebody like doubling up, like as the other person, and you replace mm-hmm. them? Is that how it works? So yeah, they can act off somebody?
We're going to have a body double for sure, maybe two, just because, you know, for like an over the shoulder,
oh, sure.
you know, for right. body placement, or like if someone hands someone something, or if there's yeah. multiple hands, or that kind of thing. Or just have like someone's body kind of in a off the out of frame or like in frame, but you don't see their face kind of thing.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, so she can have someone to act off of because it's a comedy and it's timing. Four people. Yeah, so there's like a rhythm. Timing.
Yeah, you have to establish that. And exactly. It seems like you have to kind of establish it and then reestablish it almost mm-hmm. because you're going to have to redo the scenes mm-hmm. with the existing timing already in place, right? I guess editing will help a lot too.
Editing will help. You know, cutaways will help.
Do you have an editor, or are you going to edit?
Not yet. Okay. Some people in mind, but it's going to be a fun, edit.
Mm-hmm. It'll be a fun challenge, yeah, for any editor. Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I could see this as being a real fun thing.
Well, the thing is, I think that with shooting, it's going to be interesting because usually if there's only one main character, all of the perspective is kind of either from them or towards them. Mm-hmm. But because all four of them really have their own moments, it's kind of like four completely different perspectives. And since, again, we're playing with them really being the same person, there's like an opportunity to play with, like, you know, who is the center of the conversation, but also making sure that it's really clear to the audience who each one is and all that kind
yeah,
of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
And what their point of view are.
Well, that, yeah, you'll have to create some sort of way of doing that, which sounds like just once you have it, you'll know it'll be clear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll have found a way to do that so we don't confuse the Deborahs.
Yeah. Well, they'll look different, too.
Of course.
They'll have different, like, costumes and
right.
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No doubt.
But, yeah, of course. But, like, there's just something that's going to be a fun, like, cinematography challenge, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you, in writing the screenplay, I guess, have you had to work out all of that, just the logistics? And is that all part of what you're doing already, or is that the next step? Like, you know already, maybe you already have the script, or I guess it's a screenplay.
Yeah, the script is done.
Yeah,
the script
right.
is done. Now that Adenike has been cast,
right.
We're going to work together to okay. make sure the characters, like, fit different things that she's interested in trying out and mm-hmm. are a little bit wrapped around her personality as well, just to make it feel really authentic since it's so personal.
Right.
But the script is done, and I have a DP, but I don't want to say who they are yet, just in case they have to drop out.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm excited about
I'll
who
leave
it
this
is
out.
Right now.
Oh, who is it? I'll leave this part out. I'm just curious to know.
If
I
may Autumn not even Eakin. Know.
Who?
Autumn Eakin.
Autumn Eakin. Okay. What has she done?
She has had numerous films at Sundance, mm-hmm. and she worked on this Lena Dunham, like, Lenny project that I did last year as well that was at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
And she just shot a film with the actress from Jane the Virgin.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Jane the Virgin and Lakeith Stanfield. A new film, a new Netflix project.
Right, okay, yeah.
yeah. So she's great.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully, we can keep her.
Yeah, I hope. Good luck with that. I hope so. And you'll just have to. Those listening will just have to keep checking back and keep in touch with the film.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, again called Me Time. We're going to we'll just keep following Me Time and through its fruition. How's that?
That sounds great.
So you were mentioning, of course, the subject matter, which is, I don't know, it is sort of, sexually speaking, it's the last frontier masturbation, isn't it? It's like everything around regarding sex is sort of, I think, been
it's been done or like...
Yeah, it's out there.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know.
I don't know about everything, but yeah, a lot of things. A lot of the mainstream things.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of the non-mainstream as well, however. But it does seem like this is a subject which people find harder to talk about. Maybe less so, though, than years ago. But it's such an important... You know, you talk about making a short being part of the necessary process to become a filmmaker in the journey. Because, you know, making a feature is a huge thing. And it helps a heck of a lot if you've already made a bunch of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I'm sure, producing projects helps become a filmmaker, etc., all these things. So likewise, let me draw a comparison. You know, when you're figuring out sexuality and you want to engage with someone else, which I hear can be very, you know, gratifying. How do you get there? Well, masturbation. It's a very good way to get things going, you know?
So sure,
you're learning about your body. And
you're creating making short films with masturbation.
Well... Or features with, you know, screwing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or, you know. Well,
going
I'm just saying.
Maybe it's like a first base. Maybe it's more like a first base, second base, and then going all the way, like analogy.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you got to learn how your body functions. And also for men, I can tell you, it's a good way to just control yourself.
Right.
I don't know about women.
I mean, everyone's different. See, here's the thing, though, is that people don't talk about women's sexuality, like,
no,
at all. Even in everyday kind of stuff,
only
in media, definitely not. And definitely not women of color.
Some TV shows now are starting to really do it.
Yeah.
I've seen it now with a few TV shows. I'll have to think about titles, but...
Yeah, it is coming happening more and more, but it's still constantly circling around... either a male gaze of what that might mean, like a performative aspect of masturbation from women or orgasm from women, Or it's just always about, like, you know, success or something, or like, you know, someone having a good, like, having an orgasm in a successful way, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of vulnerability around it. That's what I kind of mean, you know?
In what way do you mean?
In the way that, so the whole film, so Me Time is really kind of around Deborah saying to her other selves, mm-hmm. I'm stressed out and want to decompress, and a soulful Deb is like, let's get it on solo kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so what happens ultimately is that Scaredy Deb sort of make questions to all of them whether they've really had an orgasm or not. And they're kind of, at first they're kind of like, oh yeah, sure, of course, you know, duh, because it's like, this is this performative faking thing they're even doing for yourself in many ways for a lot of women. And I think that, like, that kind of truth mm-hmm. is not discussed very much in the media. Like the different levels of dissatisfaction or uncertainty, or it's like the inhibitions or the questioning of pleasure, you know? And because in social interactions, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who get what they want, you know, in bed, and that's fantastic. But there are a lot of social interactions where women's pleasure is still very much on the back burner. Mm-hmm. And so I think we don't talk about that as much mm-hmm. in the media. And I want to, like, be honest about that and do it in a way that's, like, funny and that can also be empowering at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Is Deborah also, she's kind of open sexually in terms of her partners too? Did I get that from
you? Here's the thing. It has nothing to do with partners.
It's all about Deb and her own.
It has nothing
her
to do
partners
with, yeah.
are herself, parts of these
exactly.
parts of herself. Gotcha.
So this is the thing. It's like, it's not about this male gaze. It has nothing to do with anyone else. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just about
yeah.
your own thing. Like,
because Spike, of course, explored that with
yeah.
She's Got a Habit, but it, like, exactly the way you're saying. Right from his standpoint, from the men she was dating.
Exactly.
Which was still, she was very empowered. I mean, character.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's definitely a groundbreaking character, but
yes,
this kind of is exploring the next level to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's just a lot of room for mm-hmm. for women to do this journey on your own. And it's true. Yeah. I mean, yeah. it's not about other people for the most part. Mm-hmm. And like you were trying to saying earlier, you know, it's getting in tune with yourself. Well, once you choose to start engaging with other people, well, you know, will help put you in a better place, like set you up for success.
Yeah.
But, like, it's in this particular case, it's about the journey, not the destination. You know?
Okay. Yeah, that destination. It's about another destination, maybe, but
yeah,
which is, you know.
It's basically like, you know how they always have, like, women going on hiking trips alone and they're like, I found myself in the woods. You know, it's like that, but it's 20 minutes in your bedroom by yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm. 20 minutes.
Depending.
Yeah, I know. And again, the campaign is ending on July 12th, you said?
Mm-hmm.
So I could see time is of the essence here, because this is now July 5th as this podcast goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a full week left to make your goal. And even though you're saying, as we're recording, you've now tipped over the 10K mark.
Mm-hmm.
Or thereabout, I'm sure you'll be well along by four more days. Sure.
We're coming up on a holiday weekend, so it's tough.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. But yeah, I never really could figure that out. You know, even with where you were helping me and a number of other people from Kickstarter
mm-hmm.
about that. And they were just like, you just do it. Just if you're going to get hung up on every single thing. Another thing I was waiting for, which at the time that I was doing it, was Trump was still relatively new in the job, and I when I was gearing up towards launching my campaign, so that would have been about a year ago
mm-hmm.
actually, because I ended up launching at the end of the year, but I was kind of already working on it during this late summer into the fall. And what I kept waiting for was, when are these, oh, and there were all these disasters happening too. So not only just coming from the White House, but also just natural disasters. And there was, like, Puerto Rico and the,
mm-hmm.
you know, that disaster. And
yeah.
And I kept waiting for the right moment where I wouldn't feel like a jerk. Hey guys, I know it sucks, Puerto Rico, and they need tons of help and resources, but hey, I could use some too. You know?
Yeah.
So I kept putting it off. And I couldn't, there was never a time.
Yeah.
That was going to be good. So eventually I just took the leap.
Yeah, I mean, I was experiencing something like that with my first week.
Yeah.
Where, because even though this immigration issue at the border has been happening for a while, it kind of really became...
Escalated
and became really prominent in people's lives.
Yeah.
The first week of this campaign.
Right.
And so again, yeah, I didn't want to be a jerk.
Yeah, and then you're making a comedy about masturbation. What could be more self-centered?
Yeah,
in a way. I'm joking with you.
No, no, it's true.
It's an important documentary. I mean, it's an important film.
No, thank you.
Subject.
No, I get it. Yeah. But that's the thing. It's like,
yeah.
I also felt like, you know, being outraged about these children being ripped from their families is more important than my short film, you know?
I don't know what you're thinking.
I don't know, yeah. But it's one of those things where it's like, everyone has a story to tell. And I feel like even hopefully one day, like those mothers or those children and those parents will have the opportunity to tell their story for themselves too. And that's what I feel like I was saying about my new chapters. I'm really focusing on telling my story and telling stories from like my perspective that other people I think will identify with, mm-hmm. that like is rarely seen. And so I feel grounded in that despite all the other BS that's happening in our country right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have to just keep telling our stories too.
Yeah, and I know that, and authenticity is so important now. And honesty, because mm-hmm. it's sort of really being tested and taken for, I don't know, just not really appreciated enough where you can find it, you know, because there's so much lying and deceit
mm-hmm.
that we're emphasizing right now. I'm saying there are a lot of good people doing a lot of great stuff, but the emphasis is so much on... negativity. It's hard. Yeah. I'm exhausted. Everybody's kind of fatigued from it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only thing is that folks who supported the first week or emailed me or whatever the first week were really excited to see something that was like maybe a little bit fun or uplifting or could give them a smile on their face because of all the junk that's going on in the world. And it's hard to be a filmmaker in this time.
Yes.
For a variety of reasons, especially if you want to make something that makes you feel good, but we desperately need this stuff too, in
sure.
a way.
Yeah.
To have balance.
Yes.
Because there is a lot of stuff on the negative side. And I've made sad movies in my time as well. But this particular moment is one that's sort of actually a complex, you know, mixture of maybe things that might feel a little bit discouraging and uplifting at the same time, all wrapped up in a comedy about masturbation.
When you finish it, where do you want it to go? Where would it be? Where are the ideal venues, or rather platforms, or what have you, where it would be seen?
Well, I mean, I'd love to premiere at a great festival, of course. And
why?
I don't know. It's
that's a good start.
At the beginning of the conversation, we were saying mm-hmm. that short films are a way to build your repertoire as a filmmaker, to communicate, like when you start making a feature.
And create relationships with festivals.
Yeah, of course. Build relationships. And also it's just great practice. I mean, that's kind of how I feel more mm-hmm. for me. It's about like really good practicing your craft, like writing and putting something together, the producing, the, you know, flexing my director muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And visualization, you know, muscles. I think that's really key for the feature that I am working on that I want to do in the next couple of years, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you like, it's in the writing phase, right?
Yeah, I have a film. It's a feature. The current title is Kayla and Eddie en Français. It was in the mm-hmm. Sundance Creative or Sundance Screenwriting Lab earlier this year in March.
Okay, congratulations on that.
Thanks.
So that's Kayla and Eddie in French? En français?
Yeah, but you'll say en français.
En français. Mais oui. my son is in Paris right now, so I'm feeling, he made me miss him. Yeah, no, I'm happy for him. I'm getting all these dispatches, you know, these photos, and he looks like...
He's never coming back.
I did get on FaceTime with him last night, and he seemed, you know, still 14-year-old, you know, not really that impressed. I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah.
But then when we were talking about the food, he sounded very excited. He said the food's very good.
Yeah.
He said, yes. Damn right it is. They invented cuisine. That's why it's called cuisine. What I was going to say, I mean, we're going to move it a little bit into, I do want to discuss that a little bit since it's something you're working on.
Sure.
In a way that we can get benefit from it, which is for listeners to hear how you, what that process of getting into the Sundance Writers Lab.
Yeah.
Whatever it's called. It's one of their labs.
Screenwriting Lab. Screenwriting Intensive.
Intensive. And so like what was involved in that? What are the expectations or what's involved? How do you get into that? You submit and then that check or something? I don't know.
I think I'm trying to remember. I think they invite, I can't remember if the screenwriting lab itself, like the bigger screenwriting lab, the major one, is invite only or if it's open call. I can't remember.
How do they know if you're word of mouth? How do they know?
Find me?
To invite somebody as opposed to taking submissions. How do they know who to invite?
Because they're tracking people, you know?
They are?
They have an eye on people. I mean, I was also in the Sundance Creative Producing Fellowship last 2 years ago. And I think that they knew that I was working on fiction stuff. And so, you know, they kind of reached out to us.
Because you create relationships and then word of mouth.
Yeah.
Whoever's...
But they're watching us. They're all watching us at all times. They know exactly what we're doing.
big brother. Jesus.
No, in a great way. In a big brother in a healthy way. In a way that's like looking out for you, which is great.
Right. Yeah. The good big brother.
Yeah.
Not the one on TV or the one big or sister. William one. Big sister.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. So you're working on this. This came out of that. Or mm-hmm. Did you go in with a seed or do you actually have like a draft?
Yeah. No, you go. Yeah, I went in with an eighth draft.
Eighth draft.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay.
I think I had the most drafts, though. I think everyone else was on their first or second draft.
Really?
I believe so. I didn't ask everyone, but I think most people are in their.
Is this like 100-page?
Yeah, it's 105 pages right now.
Wow. Good for you.
Thanks.
I was going to ask you because I'm working on something myself, which has been in the process of. I look forward to. I gotta let them know about it, but I. Get the word out, I guess. Start to make it known, so they can keep their eye on me.
Exactly.
It's all women. Just so happens.
Oh.
No, mine is.
Oh, in your film.
Just weird. I didn't plan it. It was based on a true event that I was. It wasn't like a big event. It was a small thing that happened. But I was in the kitchen of a friend's house upstate when it. The kernel of this story,
right.
Where it was, I was hearing it unfold, and all the story involved. Like a mother and an aunt and a daughter / niece, whatever. And her friend, who is a woman, young woman. So it was like all the characters in the story were these women. But it sparked this idea. And so I just used that situation as a kind of launching point. And so all the main characters are women.
Cool.
So, hashtag that motherfucker. I don't know. I'm just hoping it's not a bad thing, you know. I mean, I like the idea of like having a female director.
Yeah.
On this.
Okay, so you were just writing the screenplay.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to direct it. I mean, I can't direct a feature. I got to do some shorts. I'm not a filmmaker, historically speaking. I produced a couple of small things, but I'm not, or co-produced, or associate produced at this stage. But I have not directed.
That would be awesome to have a woman director involved.
I totally would love that. I think that would be a great idea, and it would be a great way in for me to learn that, and I could produce or be a producer on it.
Yeah.
But anyway, anything else? So good luck with that.
Thank you.
And good luck with the campaign.
Yeah, I can say, I don't know. I guess I'll wait and say what the film feature is about.
Yeah, you can.
It's about
as much as you want.
It's basically a father daughter, kind of odd couple, fish out of water story. This black father and daughter who end up in Paris together.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter has a work trip out there, and the dad decides
she has
a work trip.
Oh, okay. She's a grown woman.
So a grown woman daughter has a work trip. The father is a former addict, a drug addict, and they've. Never really made amends, and
a lot of, right.
And then, you know, something happens where he kind of, he realizes that he needs to try to do that and try to, you know, and buys a ticket to Paris and follows her. And it's kind of about the two of them figuring out how to be the right person for each other on this trip.
Mm.
But yeah, it's also a comedy. I guess it's kind of a drama. It's like a family dramedy, I would say.
Yeah. Well, you know, getting the tone is always key, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the work is.
Yeah.
Mm. And in the script as well as in the direction, the editing, everything.
Yeah.
But when I watch the shorts for New York Film Festival, which I've been doing, so submit next for the, that's a good thing to do.
Mm, thanks.
But no, like for next year.
Yeah, it's probably too late.
Yeah, oh, it is. It's they close. No, I mean they like, the deadline passed.
It's like May. Yeah.
But they don't take features anymore. Unsolicited.
Oh yeah.
They only. Yeah. That's really relatively new.
Yeah.
Where they just now, because they weren't accepting them all this time, but they were taking the submission fees. So they realized this is not a good thing. We have to stop doing it.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, they were, I mean, technically, is that the right way to put it?
This is a very low
number. They were looking at them, they were watching, but they realized they weren't accepting any of them. Yeah. It was so almost, yeah, infinitesimally small number. Yeah. And they said, so it's just a little look good or smell good or whatever. So but they do take shorts. So I've seen some. A lot of, you know, about 100 shorts, and I next year, hopefully I'll be doing it again, you know, so.
Cool.
But it'd be good to get in there.
Yeah.
In film festival.
I mean, it'd be awesome to play a couple of great film festivals, and, you know, shorts distribution these days is really tricky.
Yeah, sure it is. Hasn't it always been?
Yeah, but you think it would be getting less tricky, but I don't think it really is.
Well, it seems like there's more festivals for shorts than ever.
Yeah, and I mean outside of festivals.
Right, no, I know what you mean. But that is a distribution if there's enough festivals.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's face it, you can get people into a theater. Like, you know, if you let's say, just want to focus on the Northeast, festivals in the Northeast, and just do a ton, small and not really caring the size of them, like you said, or let's say you got lucky and got one of the big festivals. But if you wanted you have your pedigree there and you've got your premiere, but then if you want to just do lots of festivals, you could do a bunch in the New York area and get everybody out, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know what other options there are until online or.
Yeah, online. I mean, there are a few folks out there who are buying shorts, and there are definitely a few like platforms for showing a short.
Yeah.
And they have audiences, which is nice. Audiences already.
That is good.
Like Vimeo, of course, or Short of the Week.
Oh, right. Short of the Week. Yeah, there's a few others.
Topic.com is showing.
Which
is
one?
Acquiring shorts. Topic.com.
Topic.com. I have to check that out. I didn't know about them.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're part of First Look Media.
Okay.
I'm working for them right now, full disclosure.
Oh.
If
only you had an in there. Kind of a... could possibly be a conflict of interest too. Yeah, you don't think about people buying shorts, but sure.
They're here and there, and I feel like I wish that, like,
do you have festival fees ever? Like,
if it got
into Sundance or something?
I doubt it. I wish that places like Alamo would be better at buying shorts because they have a captive audience, you know, people who are like ordering their food ahead of time, you're sitting there before the feature begins.
And they're playing all that.
They're playing all these like random,
silly,
you know, hipster things, which is nice. But it's like you could also help a filmmaker build an audience and play, you know, two short films before the feature begins.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to do that while people are milling in and about.
But they'll be quiet. If people knew that there were shorts before the feature, I feel like people would go early, order beer, and sit down and
watch
the film.
Would you mind it in that context? Would you mind it if the lights were still up?
I don't think I would mind because having been to the Alamo, it's not full lights up, you know. It's like it is pretty already like hospitable when you walk in there.
Well, yeah, because you've got to see what other hipster stuff as you've labeled it, what they're playing, so they know they can't keep the lights fully up so people wouldn't be able to see anything on the screen and they want to you know.
I think it'd be great. Like even Metrograph, you know, like folks that are really that get what we're talking about.
Yeah,
smaller theaters to do something like that.
Yeah,
but even that's just like bigger theaters like Landmark, you know.
Yeah, but there are a number of film. It's true. There are a number of theaters, art house and otherwise, that are coming from a filmmaker's, if not vantage point, advocacy.
Yeah.
And as opposed to the what we look back at as the chains that are more in bed with, if we want to say that, with distributors or sales agents, that kind of side of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Metrograph is a great example. Film Forum is probably another.
Yeah.
Draft House, possibly, that where they're actually really behind the filmmaker and what's at their interests.
Yeah.
Have their interests at heart.
You should try it out.
Yeah.
But there's also spaces, you know, like Refinery. I'd love for this film.
I haven't been there either, yeah.
No, I mean like online, like Refinery 29 is an online thing. But I feel like I'd love to get this film, in particular, me time to, you know, women-centered spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there is, I think, hopefully an opportunity for like, you know, community-type screenings and like community outreach for this kind of film. Because mm-hmm. it's also going to be like 10 minutes and... It'll probably even maybe okay to show to high school kids, you know, potentially. Wow. We'll see.
Public schools might be
we'll see how it looks at the end of the day.
Stick with the charter schools and the
girls' program, like after school programs, and there's opportunities there.
Yeah, I think some of these taboos have to be.
Well, if we taught girls to masturbate more intentionally, there might be. I mean, there'd definitely be obviously like a whole generation of girls who are much happier in their lives, but also
there might
be an impact on how promiscuous kids are these days and how safe they are and where they look for pleasure and mental health, et cetera, et cetera. Also how boys develop that could really help, you know, with girls being more empowered and aware of their bodies and their own feelings.
Right. This is only going to help boys in the long run, I think. You know, and also, well, taking also these the men have a lot of pressure too, sexually speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of messages that we're getting also,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I think another real problem is which you know has to be really dealt with is pornography because mm-hmm. it's getting to younger people all the time. It's really really. You know, it's a mixed signal because on one hand, you want to teach people that mm-hmm. sexual content shouldn't be something to be ashamed of. However, the porn industry is not doing a great job of really, you know, it's not about sex often. It's not about sexuality, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's not really about a person.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so like it's not the right messaging to send to young people or even anyone. But, you know, at least as adults, hopefully you've reached a certain level where you can kind of decide for yourself.
Yeah.
But anyhow, yeah.
The other fun thing, by the way, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. me time is that, like I was saying, the chatter in your heads, these different psych parts of Deborah are also represent like her internal monologue and an internal conversation. And
right, yeah.
That's something that is super rare for one, definitely a woman of color. Like mm-hmm. I've tried to make a list of films that where there's a woman of color where you really get a sense of her thought process on film, either through narration or through like an explicit, you know, representation of internal mindsets, you know, like with other films that I've always loved, like Memento or I Huckabees or these other, you know, there's always a white man that we get very clearly what they're thinking in their heads. And it's always, of course, very fascinating, but there's very rarely moment opportunity for women to have that same kind of screen time prominence put on what is going on in their heads,
mm-hmm.
and even more rarely for women of color. So I'm excited for me time to kind of try to help open that up even more.
When this connects with audiences, you're going to then want to adapt it into a feature? A little too soon to ask. Let's focus on the short for now.
I don't know if we need. I know in films don't need to be. I don't think this needs to be a feature.
Yeah, right. In other words, what you're saying is just because you have successful masturbation doesn't mean you have to go and then have sex with somebody else to prove it, that make it.
You could just be by yourself forever. That's my plan.
No, don't do that.
Just kidding.
Good. All right. Well, this has been great.
Yeah, let's thank not you wait so much another, for having me.
Oh, sure. Let's not wait another 400 episodes.
Yeah.
No, you'll come back on for... Well, you can come back in any time, of course.
Yeah, I'll come back for Kayla and Eddie.
Kayla and Eddie, mm-hmm. en français.
Mm-hmm.
And then après... I don't know how you say it. Après ça, how do you say after that?
Play what?
Et cetera, et cetera. There.
Oh.
Just, you know, on and on.
Nice.
All right, well, thanks again.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, next week, the team from the film Eighth Grade, it's opening on July 13th, just like Dark Money. I'm constantly in this position where I have to, you know, recommend several titles that all are opening and somewhat compete, to some degree competing. I don't look at like that Eighth Grade and Dark Money are going to be competing. They're entirely two different films. And frankly, they're both worth seeing, and you can make a weekend of it. Escape the heat and go to the movies and see Dark Money and see also Eighth Grade. I'm going to take my kid who just graduated from the Eighth Grade, because even though it's rated R, I want to take him to see it. The director will be on. His name is Bo Burnham. You know him from his comedy. And he's going to be joined by three of the actors from Eighth Grade. I haven't done something like this since I had the whole team of Patty Cakes on about a year or so ago, right? This is fun. We're going to have on the main actor. Her name is Elsie Fisher, making her debut. It's stunning performance. Stunning. I mean, she'll break your heart. No kidding. You have to see this movie. Also, one of the main characters in the film, Josh Hamilton, plays her dad. He's going to be on. Finally getting Josh Hamilton on for the first time. I'm going to get him back on for Solo. I mean, I'm going to work on that. And also Emily Robinson, who plays another character in the film, another important character. Again, it's called Eighth Grade. It's being distributed by A24, and we're going to have on those four folks on the next episode. To repeat myself, I'm not going to announce it. I'm just telling you right now, if you're listening to this outro right now, that means you are probably a faithful listener to the show, because you're listening to me, not my guests. So, or I don't know where you are, but if you're listening, do yourself a favor. Check in again next week on the next episode. But perhaps you're already subscribed and it comes to your phone or your tablet automatically. That's the way it should work. If it doesn't, you can rectify that situation. Go to iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. We're not on Spotify, but we are on those two platforms. Go there and subscribe. Leave us a review, please. It can be just a couple of words. It doesn't have to be a paragraph, but whatever. Leave some constructive criticism. I could take it. And let's leave a star rating, if that is an option. And, follow what we're doing. The show's, as we're approaching the 500th episode, it feels like we're just kind of hitting adolescence here. I mean, some of these podcasters, I listen to Mark Maron. I listen to Joe Rogan. I mean, these guys, they're pumping out two episodes a week or more. And, hours long in some cases. I'm just, I'm doing the best I can. So next episode you'd know about now. Sort of. I've teased you a little bit about the other one. But I can tell you that this mystery guest is somebody I've been coveting as a guest for a long time. And I've tried to get them on with the last couple of films, and finally it worked. So you know that they're prolific. I'll tell you that. They've been around a while. And they have a new movie also opening up next Friday. So that actually means I'm recommending three movies next Friday, July 13th. You've got the Dark Money documentary. You've got Eighth Grade. And then this third film, which I haven't mentioned yet, but is spectacular. All three films. So I'm going to be telling people to spend like all next weekend in the movie theaters under the air conditioning. Okay. I've said my bit. I pitched everything I need to pitch. And one last thing, go to our YouTube channel and check us out there. Just go to YouTube and search Filmwax Radio like you would on any of the other social media platforms. We put up all of our segments. Every conversation goes up as a standalone audio file. So you can go up and just listen to, my conversation, say, with Iabo or Kimberly. And as is, you don't have to listen to the entire episode in my ramblings. But, listen, I wish you would. Okay, I'm going to sign off now, and we'll be back next Thursday. Rest in peace to Robbie Mueller, the great cinematographer who passed away this week. Reminds me, we're also going to be having Ed Lockman on in the next couple of weeks. That episode's also been recorded some time ago, and we'll get that up shortly. All right, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff. You've been listening to episode 494 of Film Wax Radio. Please take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings.